As we kick off the new year, many of us resolve to grow closer to God. But how do we actually do that? Well, we have a resource to help you do just that through our free ebook, 5 Ways to Connect with God. This resource shares 5 simple but powerful spiritual practices to deepen your relationship with God, from cultivating thankfulness to asking God for a word for the year. This guide will help you to find rest, focus, and renewed connection with God as we begin the new year. Download your copy now at premierinsight.org. Start your year off closer to God. That's premierinsight.org. Now, let's get started with today's episode.
Hello and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, and this is the show that brings different points of view together each week for dialogue and debate as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio. Though on this edition of the show, we're going to be having a one-to-one chat with an esteemed Christian philosopher. I'll be introducing him in a moment's time. Later on in the show, we'll hear some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme, quite a stack that built up over the summer break. And straight after today's programme, on The Profile, Sam Hales will be speaking to Alistair Begg. He's a British preacher who leads a large church out in the USA, talking about his radio ministry and why he left Scotland to minister in the USA. The Profile available, of course, as a podcast. You can look that up on iTunes or whatever you use to get your podcasts. And of course, this show, Unbelievable, also popular with many people around the world as a podcast. There are links available from the show webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and access to some 10 years now of the show on archive. And of course, I've been talking about 10 years of doing the show, talking to atheists a lot of the time in my recently released book, Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. Got more exciting news on that front to share with you a little bit later on in the programme. But if you want to check it out for yourself, do go to the dedicated book website where you can get signed copies, links to the audiobook and much more besides. That's all at unbelievablebook.co.uk. So whether you're listening this Saturday afternoon or somewhere around the world via our podcast, thank you for choosing to spend the next hour and a half with Unbelievable. Let me tell you what's coming up today.
You're unbelievable.
Well, it's a privilege to be joined on Unbelievable today by Alvin Plantinga, Emeritus Professor of Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame and this year's Templeton Prize winner. It's an award given to a living individual who's made an exceptional contribution to affirming life's spiritual dimension. Alvin has been awarded the prize for his long career, bringing arguments for God back into the mainstream of academic philosophy, laid out in works like God, Freedom and Evil, Knowledge and Christian Belief, Warranted Christian Belief, and Where the Conflict Really Lies. So today on the show, I'll be talking to Alvin about his career, the prize, and we'll be putting a whole host of questions about his philosophy to him, all sent in recently by email, Twitter and Facebook by you, the Unbelievable listeners. We're going to be asking about things like the evolutionary argument against naturalism, where the conflict really lies between science, religion and naturalism, the ontological argument, the free will defence of the problem of evil, a warranted belief, whether belief in God is properly basic, and what exactly all those things mean too. We even have questions about the state of his air conditioning unit, but we'll get to that later on. Alvin Plantinga, thank you for joining me on the programme today.
My pleasure. Happy to be there. Here.
It's great to have you from across the pond talking to us here on the UK's Unbelievable show. And your name crops up very frequently in some of the conversations we have on this program between Christians and non-Christians. I think it's no exaggeration to say that you are probably the most influential living Christian philosopher today, Alvin. But before we get into that, I'd love to go back to the beginning a little bit and ask, did you grow up with a Christian faith? How did things begin for you?
I did grow up in the Christian faith. My parents were Christians. My father actually did a certain amount of preaching when I was a young fellow. He would preach at churches that were vacant and the like of that. And my relatives on all sides were pretty much Christians.
So was that something that sort of just naturally you followed in the path of, or was there a particular moment at which you embraced that for yourself?
It seemed a natural thing to do, and I just went along with it as part of my family, so to speak, until I was about 15 or 16. And then it suddenly came alive and seemed real and seemed part of me, something that was very important to me. So it was initially following the crowd or following the family, but then later on, this sort of sudden awakening.
Mm. Did you ever consider going into the kind of church ministry that your forebears had been involved in?
I did consider that. I think fortunately for the church, I decided against that.
And fortunately for philosophy as well, because obviously this then became your career, your passion. What got you into philosophy in the first place, Alvin?
Well, my father was a professor at Jamestown College in Jamestown, North Dakota. When I was growing up, from the time I was maybe, I don't know, from seventh grade to senior high school, and he was a philosopher. He taught both philosophy and psychology. So I heard a lot of philosophy around our house, and I talked about it quite a bit with my father. And it always seemed to me to be, as far as I was concerned, the natural thing to do is to go into philosophy.
At the time you were entering philosophy, what did the landscape look like? Was it essentially dominated by a fairly skeptical view of God at that point?
I think it would be fair to say that. I think it would be fair to say that at that time, this would be 1950-ish, at that time, most philosophers, nearly all philosophers, were non-Christians. There were some Christian philosophers around, but I think for the most part, they kept a low profile. It wasn't the done thing, and it wasn't very popular then.
I mean, you're very much credited with leading the modern revival of Christian philosophy. Firstly, why did it almost die out, and why has it come back again?
Well, I think those are hard questions to answer. I don't know why it almost died out. Christianity almost died out among philosophers. It would be an exaggeration to say that it died out, and maybe an exaggeration to say it almost did. There were Christian philosophers all around at those times. For example, at Calvin College, the philosophers where I was a student were Christians, and mm-hmm. other places too. There was Bill Frankina, chairman of the University of Michigan Philosophy Department. But ones in places like state universities, as with Bill Frankina, tended to sort of keep their Christianity under their hat.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, did you kind of give people permission to sort of put their faith out there when it came to their philosophy again, do you think, in some of the stuff that you started to research and publish?
Well, possibly. With me, there wasn't. I mean, Bill Frankina kept his Christianity under his hat because he was at a state university and it was sort of unpopular to be a Christian there and then. I was never in a situation like that. I taught at Calvin College, where it's certainly perfectly okay to be a Christian, and at Notre Dame, where the same is also true. So I didn't have the same problem as some of the others did.
Why, though, would you say there has been something of a revival in Christian philosophy? Because I think it's fair to say that certainly there has been a lot more people who now do classify themselves as Christian in mainstream philosophy, let's say, especially when it comes to philosophy of religion?
You know, these questions are extremely hard to answer as to why these things happen or how they happen. If my work played some role in it, I would be delighted. What kind of role it played, though, I think is pretty hard to say.
Well, that's very modest, and I appreciate that, Alvin. Tell us about the Templeton Prize, and what does it mean to you to have been awarded this particular prize this year?
Well, I was very surprised to hear about that. In fact, I had just barely heard of the Templeton Prize, and then I got this call from Heather Templeton one day saying I had won this award and that it was worth $1 million or £1 million, I guess it was. So I was, to tell you the truth, I was really astonished.
I know. I mean,
however, I'm not going to turn it down on that account.
I was going to say, it's a nice kind of a call to get out of the blue, isn't it?
I should say, yeah.
I won't be so bold as to ask exactly what you're going to do with the prize money, but nonetheless, an amazing recognition of your life's work, I would say. So it must be very gratifying to have it honored in this particular way.
Well, it certainly is very gratifying. As I say, I'm not at all sure I deserve it, but but I'll take it nonetheless. And as you say, it is exceedingly gratifying.
Well, look, congratulations on being awarded the Templeton
Thank
Prize.
You.
I believe you're officially receiving it later on in September. I've had the privilege of interviewing the previous two recipients as well, Jonathan Sachs and Jean Vanier, in the last 2 years. So it's turning into a bit of a tradition, to be able to interview the winner each year. We're going to do something. You've very kindly offered to have a whole bunch of questions thrown at you on today's programme, Alvin. It's our Ask Alvin Plantinga Anything edition of Unbelievable Today. And I asked you a little while back to send in your questions for Alvin, and far more than I could possibly fit into today's programme were sent through. So I do apologise to those who aren't going to have their question read out, but we will try to get to as many as possible. Of course, today's programme is going to be a deeply philosophical programme as well, as we explore some of the key concepts and philosophical ideas that Alvin Plantinga has shaped during the course of his career. So I do ask you to listen closely, and if you've got the podcast facility, you might even want to rewind back and listen again occasionally. But we'll try and make sure we keep it at an understandable, comprehensible level throughout as well. If you want to get in touch with the programme today, you can email in, of course, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Look forward to hearing what you thought about today's show. And of course, you can find us online as well, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. There you'll find today's programme. You can comment underneath that. You can find further resources there. And of course, links to our social media as well. Again, you can get in touch that way too. We're at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter account, and facebook.com/unbelievableJB for the Facebook page.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So why don't we jump right in, Alvin, to some of the questions that have been asked by the Unbelievable listeners. I've got a number of general questions plus some specific areas that people have been very interested to look at. And obviously we'll need you to spell out briefly at least some of the concepts that we're going to be talking about on the show today. Perhaps one of the things you're best known for in your published work is what you've done on warranted belief and properly basic beliefs. And we've got a number of questions around that. So would you, first of all, perhaps just spell out what you mean by a warranted belief or properly basic beliefs, and how that relates to belief specifically in God?
Well, I was thinking of a warranted belief, or I was thinking of warrant as that property such that when you add it to truth in a belief, what you get is knowledge. So warrant is what makes belief into knowledge.
Okay.
And what was the other part of your question? Basic belief?
Yeah, and what is a basic belief as opposed to warranted belief?
And a basic belief is just a belief that you accept not on the basis of any other belief. So you don't argue to it from other things you believe. It's sort of a starting point instead. I mean, among my basic beliefs would be that I'm sitting in a chair and that I live in Michigan and like that. These are beliefs that they're sort of immediate beliefs. They're starting points for your whole intellectual enterprise.
And do you count belief in God in that sense as also one of these properly basic beliefs?
Right. I mean, a properly basic belief, as opposed just to a basic belief simpliciter, is one such that it's rational to hold that belief in the basic way. I guess there are some beliefs such that it wouldn't be rational to hold them in a basic way. For example, if I just believed in the basic way that the sun was 93 million miles away, I never heard that, never read it, anything like that, I just believed it. You know, I just came up with it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. That wouldn't be reasonable or rational. But if I believe in the basic way that that I'm looking at my right hand, that would be rational. That's not the sort of belief you have to reason to from other beliefs.
Sure. So, and so when you come to belief in God, do you see belief in God as one of these properly basic beliefs, one that we don't necessarily have to be able to reason to if it's apparent to us that God does exist?
I do. I think belief in God is a properly basic belief, one such that you don't have to reason to it. I mean, you can reason to it. There are reasonably good arguments for the existence of God, but I don't think those arguments are strong enough to support the degree of strength of the belief that people ordinarily have in God. I think God has rather instilled in us a kind of what Calvin calls a sensus divinitatis, a sense of his presence. On many occasions, his presence seems sort of obvious or even overwhelming sometimes.
Mm. So what do you say then to the atheist who says, well, I don't have this properly basic belief that you say you have, Alvin? I think you're deluded, frankly, and really you do need evidence if you're going to claim belief in God. You can't just tell me it's something, you know, that you apprehend without needing to have any rational evidence for it, because I certainly can't see it myself. Where do you begin with that kind of an objection?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I really don't know what to say. I mean, I guess I have a sympathy for someone who's got no sense of God's presence in their life. I don't feel inclined to revile them or anything like that. But also the fact that God isn't apparent to them in that way doesn't mean that God isn't apparent to me.
Okay.
And others to whom God seems to be apparent.
And if they say, no, God has, if you claim there is a God, you have to show me evidence, your view is actually, no, it's simply enough that that I apprehend the existence of God, I don't need to provide evidence in order to know that's true myself, as it were.
That's what I think.
Mm.
Of course, I might need to provide evidence to try to persuade the atheist that there is such a person as God. That's an entirely different enterprise.
Mm. Okay. I think that's very helpful for distinguishing what it is and you it isn't that you're, as it were, trying to show with a properly basic belief. Well, let's get into some questions that people sent in this area. Here's one from Michael Grenholm on Facebook, who says, Dear Dr. Plantinga, thank you for your invaluable work to strengthen Christian apologetics and philosophy. I've always wondered what arguments there are for viewing belief in God as a properly basic belief. Most defences I've heard for this proposition concentrate on arguing for the validity of counting some beliefs as properly basic, rather than describing why belief in God should be properly basic and not a contingent belief. I understand why we ought to think like that for theological reasons, but I do find it hard to convince an atheist that this would be the case. So do you want to just spell out what you think Michael is sort of asking here at this point, Alvin?
Well, I think there are two things going on there. One question is whether belief in God is basic, whether he, as a Christian, should think of belief in God as in the basic way, or whether he should think that it requires argument. The other question is, how do you talk to an atheist about this?
Mm.
You know, the atheist doesn't believe in God in a basic way or in any other way, and the atheist may think that you don't have a right to believe in God in a basic way. As for the first, then I guess I'd say it's same as I already have, that it is perfectly proper to believe in God in a basic way. There's no requirement. It's not irrational or contrary to reason to accept God without argument. As for the second, I guess I'd want to know. We'd have to talk to the atheist and question in more detail and find out why he or she thinks that belief in God isn't properly basic. What's the principle in which you classify beliefs that are properly basic? Beliefs into the kind that are properly basic and the kind that are not properly basic.
Let's talk about another question that came in. This is from Guillaume Bignon. He says, Professor Plantinga, you famously and convincingly suggested that human knowledge of a proposition occurs when we hold a true belief that also has enough warrant, and you analysed warrant to be what we have when a belief is produced by cognitive faculties functioning properly in an environment for which they were designed according to a design plan aimed at truth. So we already talked a little bit, didn't we, about warrant early on. Yeah, so he goes on, so far so good. I like your proposal a lot. With such a view of warrant, though, I wonder about God's knowledge. Presumably you affirm that God knows lots of propositions too, all of them really. But then how do you analyse knowledge in God's case? The idea of a design plan for God's cognitive faculties doesn't sound right, given that he's not a designed being. Does that mean God's knowledge isn't to be analysed in terms of warrant? Or is it just that warrant is defined differently in the case of God? If so, is it still overlapping somewhat with the analysis of warrant you gave for humans? In short, how do you suggest we understand God's knowledge in contrast to your proposal for human knowledge? So the distinction here between the way God knows things and the way humans know things. What do you have to say to Guillaume, Alvin?
Well, I think Guillaume is right in suggesting that God doesn't have what you could literally call a design plan. If a design plan involves the thing that has its being designed. But you could instead of thinking of a design plan for an organ or for something of that sort, you could think just of the way the thing actually works, how it works. And then, of course, that would be true for God. There is a way in which God's knowing faculties really work. I mean, God is essentially omniscient, which is to say he automatically knows everything, has no false beliefs, and with respect to any proposition knows whether or not it's true. That's the way God's intellectual faculties, if we want to put it that way, that's the way they really work. So there is that. So it's you might say that God's knowledge and our knowledge aren't the same, but they are analogically connected. There's an analogy between the two.
Thank you very much. We're talking with Alvin Plantinga today. He's, of course, Emeritus Professor of Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame and this year's Templeton Prize winner. We're talking about warranted belief and properly basic belief in God and such like. We had another question in here from Kurt Jaros, who says, Dr. Plantinga, what is the difference between a properly basic belief and a belief which is self-evident? How would you distinguish between those two types of belief?
Well, I would say that self-evident beliefs are among the properly basic beliefs, but not all basic beliefs, not all properly basic beliefs are self-evident.
Okay.
So 2 plus 1 equals 3 is self-evident, and it's also properly basic. One doesn't have to argue to it to be reasonable or anything like that. But there are other beliefs that aren't self-evident, but still are properly basic. For example, the belief that I'm sitting in a chair right now, that's not self-evident in the usual sense of self-evident anyway, but it is properly basic.
Yeah.
The belief that I've lived for a fairly long time, again, isn't self-evident, but it's properly basic. So properly basic beliefs are one kind of... self-evident beliefs are one kind of properly basic beliefs, but there are also other kinds.
Got you. That's useful. Jeffrey Timmons says, many American evangelical pastors say that they know God and that their doctrine is true. Well, given the hiddenness of God and other issues, is it fair to say that Christians should characterize their claims as actually being of warranted belief rather than truth? Would you also discuss this idea in relation to pluralism? He says, the background for my question is that I've been told by multiple pastors that a certain level of certainty is required for justification. Admitting to belief rather than confessing knowledge is not enough to be considered true saving faith. It's my understanding that empirical evidence is required to declare academically that a claim is true and that one can know it. Thanks for considering my question. So that's an interesting one. When it comes to pastors who say that they know God and that their doctrine is true, should we be more cautious and talk about warranted belief rather than truth? What's your take on this, Alvin?
Well, in the first, I mean, there's a lot of things going on in that question. In the first place, anything I believe, I must consider true. I can't believe it, but then say, but I have no idea whether or not it's true, or maybe it's false. Who knows? That doesn't make any sense, right? So you automatically think anything that you believe is true. Now, the other part of the question, or another part, was whether one could sensibly say that you know that there is such a person as God, or whether that's evincing too high a level of confidence. Well, I don't see why you can't. If it seems utterly obvious to you that there is such a person as God, as it has seemed to me on on various occasions, though, of course, not all the time. I don't see what the objection is to then speaking of knowledge.
Mm. I mean, this other part of the question where he asks about having been told by multiple pastors that a certain level of certainty is required for justification, by which I assume he means sort of saving faith. He says, admitting to belief rather than confessing knowledge is not enough to be considered true saving faith. What's your take on that? Does this come into the question of, you know, how much we have to, as it were, believe or know things to be true in order to be saved as Christians?
I don't think that. I guess I wouldn't agree there. I wouldn't agree with that. I would think that if I say, well, I certainly believe that there is such a thing as God, such a person as God, and Jesus Christ is His Son and our Savior. I believe all these things. As with the, say, Apostles' Creed, that seems to me to be perfectly sensible and enough. It's not that if you won't go on to say, well, I know that, then you are deficient or not up to snuff or something of that sort.
Sure. Since you mentioned it there, Kent Morlach had a question, which is simply, what's your favorite creed or confession? Do you have a favorite creed or confession, Alvin?
Well, there are several that I like very much. I don't know if I can speak of a favorite, but I like the Apostles' Creed. It's just brief and elegant and full, even though it's brief. I also like longer things like, say, the Heidelberg Catechism. I guess I don't really want to speak of one that I
prefer.
That's my favorite. If I did, I guess it might be the Apostles' Creed.
Do you find them useful in as much as they're sort of, you know, containers of, I suppose, the essentials of what it means to be a Christian in terms of the beliefs that one would hold?
I think that's exactly what they do, yeah. Mm.
Well, look, we're at the end of part one already, and we've got through a good number of questions on properly basic beliefs and warranted belief. We're going to be moving on to questions on free will and evil and the evolutionary argument against naturalism. We'll see what else we can fit in as well. Today, we're asking Alvin Plantinger anything. That's what I asked you to do. Send in your questions for the well-known Christian philosopher who's recently been awarded the Templeton Prize. You're listening to Unbelievable, special edition of the program, as I sit down with Alvin Plantinger to talk through these questions. Come back in a moment's time for part two.
If you want to have a massive reason why human beings are special, here it is. God became one.
We can be part of God's plan to bring hope to a hopeless generation.
We're living in an exciting time to be a follower of Jesus. The golden age of Christianity, ladies and gentlemen.
We live in a universe that has a story that is ultimately about love.
There's a God-shaped hole in the heart of every person. It can only be filled by God, made known through Jesus Christ.
Hear the world's leading Christian thinkers make the case for Christ at Unbelievable, the Conference 2017. Now available not only on DVD, but also as a digital download. Order online at premier.org.uk/shop.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's show. Very special edition of the programme. Ask Alvin Plantinger anything here on Unbelievable. You sent in your questions for the renowned Christian philosopher, who is, of course, the recipient of the Templeton Prize this year, which is an award given to a living individual who's made an exceptional contribution to understanding and affirming life's spiritual dimension. Well, Alvin Plantinger has been doing that through his work in Christian philosophy, specifically books like God, Freedom and Evil, Knowledge and Christian Belief, Warranted Christian Belief and others. And we're talking today to Alvin about his career, the prize, and putting all these questions that you sent him by email, Twitter and Facebook. Again, if you want to get in touch about today's show, you can certainly email in and I'll try and read out as many as I can on next week's show. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can catch today's show again online, send it on to friends and recommend it to others from the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Loads of other resources there, of course, including this year's Unbelievable Conference on DVD and links, of course, to Unbelievable the Book as well, where you can find out what I make of the case for God after over 10 years now of talking with skeptics and atheists on this programme. It's been quite the ride. And certainly Alvin Plantinga's work has cropped up many a time in all those discussions that we've had on the programme over the years. So we've got a lot of questions here, Alvin, and it's been tough actually sorting between them. But a few different people mentioned this, a bit of a lighter one to throw at you, including people like Rich Clark on Twitter, who asked, Justin, could you please ask Alvin how his air conditioning unit is doing? I really need closure on this. This is because one of the more quirky things that you've done is appear in a news report about the problems that people were experiencing at one time in getting their air conditioning units fixed, Alvin. Do you want to shed a little light on this story?
Well, I don't think there's a lot more to be said. my air conditioning wasn't working properly for a while, and then some people came out and fixed it. And somehow this got on the news in Grand Rapids here. There was a lot of the news people came over and wanted to know about how my air conditioning was working and how it got fixed and the like of that. But there wasn't much more to it than that. It was a sort of a semi-joke.
They didn't stop to ask you about warranted Christian belief while they were there.
No, they didn't. They didn't bring that up at all.
Well,
no.
There you go. In any case, I'm glad to hear that your air conditioning is working fine now. Let's just go to a couple of other questions before we jump into another big topic like free will and evil. Kyle wants to know, your work is deeply informed by Dutch Reformed theologians. Could you discuss the importance of studying theology when forming one's understanding of philosophy? So, how important is it to know your theology in order to understand philosophy?
Well, if you're interested in Christian philosophy or philosophy involving topics such as belief in God and so on, then I'd say it's essential to know a fair amount of theology. You don't have to actually become a licensed theologian, a card-carrying theologian, but you do have to have substantial familiarity with it, in particular because these two, philosophy and theology, and the whole Christian tradition have been very closely associated.
What areas of philosophy do you want to see more Christian advancement, asks Joachim on Facebook. Are there other areas of philosophy, apart from specifically philosophy of religion, where we could benefit from more Christians being involved?
Well, I think actually it would hold for all areas of philosophy, but one in particular would be the philosophy of the person, of what it is to be a person, what persons are like essentially, how they differ from other things. I think for Christians, it's very important to think about those from a broadly speaking theological point of view, human beings as created in God's image, and the like of that.
Do you find that philosophers like Peter Singer are, as it were, going in a very different direction in terms of what counts as a person?
They certainly are very different, and that makes sense. I mean, naturalists will think of persons in a very different way from the way in which Christians or theists more generally will. Theists or Christians, at least, will think of human beings as created in God's image. Naturalists will tend to think of human beings as just another animal with a peculiar way of making a living.
A couple of questions came in asking whether you've ever had doubts and what argument is most difficult to square with Christianity. That was asked by Matthew Boland. And a similar question on Twitter from Jack O'Grady. What's the most powerful philosophical case for atheism you've encountered, and why do you find it unconvincing? So, yeah, what has been some of the most challenging arguments against Christianity or for atheism that you've encountered, Alvin?
I don't know whether there are any arguments in particular that are challenging along those lines, but there is the existence and pervasive quality of evil. That has always been a problem for Christians and believers in God going all the way back to Job. And it's still a problem. I mean, it's hard for Christians to understand why God permits so much evil, and evil of sometimes appalling character, in his creation. And I don't know that there is any sort of knockdown, drag-out answer to that problem.
Indeed. It's one that is perennial and that every Christian struggles with, I'm sure, at some point in their life. Obviously, you have tackle this from a philosophical perspective at some level, and now is a good time to talk about your free will defense when it comes to the problem of evil. Just first of all, tell us what you are and aren't attempting to do with what you've written around the idea of free will and evil, Alvin.
Well, in the free will defense, I'm essentially arguing against the claim of some philosophers that the existence of evil just outright refutes the existence of God. There can't be both God and evil. The free will defense is an argument against that suggestion. And the basic line of the free will defense is that it's good that there be creatures who have free will, who are free, who can themselves decide what they're going to do. God thought it good to create such creatures. And as a matter of fact, some of the creatures he created with free will went wrong. And that's the source of much of the evil in the world.
And on that level, God allows free will, presumably because there's a greater good at stake if people weren't allowed to exercise free will, even though it will inevitably mean that people choose to do wrong things.
Yes, right. It's not necessarily inevitable that people will choose to do wrong things, but as a matter of fact, that's how it has turned out.
Could it have been possible for God to actualize a world in which people always chose to do the right thing?
It might be possible. I mean, maybe things are like this, that there's a world or some worlds with only two people in it, and those two people always do only what's right. Well, but God might think a world with a whole lot of people, many of whom do what's right and many of whom do what's wrong, is more valuable than a world with only two people in it. So even if there are some worlds such that there are people in them, but they only do what's right, it doesn't automatically follow that those worlds are more valuable than a world like the one that we find ourselves in.
Well, there's a lot of questions that obviously come out of this. And thank you for the brief sort of recap on the basic idea behind your work here. Edward T. Babinski is a skeptic and asks, one of the questions he asks via Twitter was, how did God, in whom there was no evil, even come up with the idea of evil? What part of God comes up with evil, even as an idea? Any response to that?
Yeah, I mean, God is part of the whole Christian idea of God is that God is omniscient. He's all-knowing. So he knows about everything. So if evil is a possibility, God would know about that possibility by virtue of being omniscient. It's not that he would have to himself be evil in order to know about evil, just as I don't myself have to be a hippopotamus to know about hippopotamy.
And another question that Edward asks on Twitter, how was there room for evil to squeeze into the picture at all if everything arose solely or directly from the power, vision, love, and goodness of God?
Well, God created human beings with, as we've been saying, with free will, with the capacity to choose what they wanted to do, with the capacity to choose between right and wrong, and in fact to choose wrong. And that's the way in which evil could get into God's world.
I guess the big thing that is obviously left, if you say go with the idea of free will, there may be a reasonable explanation for why God would allow a measure of evil to exist because of the fact of free will. The next place that many people turn is the question of natural evil, evils that don't appear to be related to people's own free choices to do wrong, earthquakes, sickness, just things that happen somewhat randomly, it would appear. And Pete Blockley and others have asked, could you briefly speak to the problem of natural evil?
Well, I think that's a much harder question. Here, the traditional Christian idea has been that God not only created human beings as free creatures, but also created many other free creatures, many angels, and also among them Satan and his cohorts, and that God permits Satan to act on his freedom as well. And Satan's aim is to subvert God's good creation and to rebel against God, so that the natural evil that one finds in the world is a result of the action of Satan and his cohorts. Now, this is not a very popular view nowadays, but I don't think that's anything against it. it has been popular other times, maybe will be popular again in the future. And it seems to me it's about as good an answer here as there is.
So would that be what you could say St. Paul is referring to in Romans when he talks about the creation groaning, as it were, and waiting to be set free from bondage to decay, that there's some sort of a cosmic spiritual battle going on that, if you like, is at the root of the natural evil we experience.
Yeah, I think that's I think that is what St. Paul's referring to, right? Yeah.
Well, on that subject, Grant Peterson, also on Facebook, asks, we hear very little apologetic discussion on the work of Satan in relation to evil and suffering. Given that the Gospels and Acts record Jesus as rebuking and destroying the works of Satan as part of his healing and miracle ministry, why don't you think it's commonly used as a defense?
I'm not sure what the answer to that is. I think lots of people are embarrassed to talk about Satan. Mm. But then if you ask why are they embarrassed, I guess I don't really know the answer to that.
I guess it doesn't very often strike people. You can have sort of, I suppose, philosophical discussions that most philosophers are willing to have about God and suffering in regard to could there be reasons why God would allow suffering. But maybe they get a little bit tetchy when you start to introduce the ideas of angelic realms and Satan and things which maybe they think that takes them beyond the kind of the classical view of God, if you like. It takes you into a much more, in a sense, first century view, you know, as depicted in the Bible of a supernatural realm. Is that something to do with it, would you say?
I think that's probably right. I think a lot of people just find it embarrassing to talk about Satan, as they might also find it embarrassing to talk about other angels. I don't see any reason, though, to be embarrassed in thinking about Satan. I mean, the Bible, as you say, clearly speaks about Satan. Jesus encounters Satan. So I don't know why Christians should be particularly embarrassed about thinking or talking about Satan.
Perry Hendricks asks, you've briefly talked about the problem of evil for naturalists. He says you referenced and quoted in an endnote in Peter Van Inwagen's book, The Problem of Evil. Can you explain what that is, the problem of evil as it occurs for naturalists, not just for Christians?
Yes, what I had in mind was this. If you're a naturalist, then there will be things that you don't like very well, you know. I mean, people getting sick and so on, and there'll be a lot of things that are contrary to what you think things ought to be like, perhaps. But if you're a naturalist, you can't think about the true depths of evil. The true depths of evil have to do with rejecting God, with turning your back on God, with, as in Satan's case, trying to become like God yourself, or to become God, or maybe to get rid of God. Those things are not those ways of evil, which I would think are sort of monumentally evil, worst kinds of evil. Those are kinds of evil that aren't available in a naturalistic universe.
And in a sense, there are more resources for the Christian for understanding evil in that sense than available to the naturalist. That's an interesting perspective. There are other questions here on the question of evil. I mean, one, though, that occurs to me is that I know that you've spoken about the fact that we have a world in which God came, in the Christian view, to his creation and died in order to redeem it. And you've worked that into some of your work on the problem of evil and suffering, to say, what if, in fact, a world in which God can actualize that kind of a reality might just be the best of all possible worlds because of the extraordinary depth of love and grace that can be shown in that act. Would you want to sort of talk a little bit about that before we move on?
Yeah, well, I think you've put it very well. You can also look at it from this point of view. We don't know why God permits all the evil that the world contains. And it does contain some utterly appalling kinds of evil and very widespread kinds of evil. We don't know that, but we do know, from a Christian point of view, that God himself was willing to enter into our world by virtue of Jesus Christ, his Son. And his Son, himself God, was willing to suffer and die for our salvation, was willing to suffer and die to enable us to find a way out of our predicament. So while we may not know why God permits evil, the fact that he was himself willing to undergo suffering, pain, and evil gives us heart, or gives us, if not an answer to the question, why is there evil, gives us a way of sort of putting up with it.
Yeah, a way to get through it, at the very least. Let's move on from some of these questions around free will and evil to what I referenced earlier, the evolutionary argument against naturalism. Now, at a popular level, you've talked about this in your book, Where the Conflict Really Lies. But for those, and especially, of course, the last time you joined me on Unbelievable was for a fantastic discussion you had with atheist philosopher Stephen Law about this. That goes back several years now, and I will put a link to that particular discussion in the details of today's program online. If you want to find that, that'll be at the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. But just remind us again, briefly, what the evolutionary argument against naturalism is exactly.
Well, very briefly, it's the idea that if naturalism were true, then we could perhaps trust our cognitive faculties to some degree with respect to questions about how to find food and how to find shelter, how to find a mate and the like of that. But when it comes to questions of, you might say, metaphysics or questions of religion, there wouldn't be any reason whatever to trust our cognitive faculties. They wouldn't be, the way in which they come to be wouldn't aim them in the right direction. It would be just kind of hit or miss affair as to whether or not our faculties were reliable when it comes to things like what the world is like, whether there's such a person as God, and so on. But from a theistic perspective, that's very different. Then God would have created us in such a way that we could know not only these things about everyday life, how to find food and the like, but also that we would know something about God himself and be able to be in a relationship with God. So that would be the basic idea there.
And in a sense, the argument you've made is that if a purely naturalistic account of evolution is true, that, of course, means that our the beliefs we have are simply directed towards survival rather than them being true necessarily. And in a sense, that sort of undercuts the very, idea you're trying to prove. You know, the scientific endeavor is undercut if actually we can't necessarily trust our beliefs apart from the degree to which they lend us survival value.
Yeah, that's in fact what Darwin himself thought the same thing. He said, this, "But then with me the horrid doubt always arises whether the convictions of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of the lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. Would anyone trust in the convictions of a monkey's mind, if there are any convictions in such a mind?" So Darwin himself had this serious question, which I called Darwin's doubt.
It's a really interesting proposition, and one which, of course, many people have responded to, because, of course, it's rather handing the problem back to the atheist and the naturalist to say, well, you're a great believer in the theory of evolution, but it does have this rather tricky consequence for you that you don't really have any real justification for believing what you actually believe if it's all down to this this process which doesn't really value truth. It only values the things that help us to survive. Now, this, of course, has been written about, in many, many places. I mean, one of the most obvious questions that occurs to me, and of course was the question that you debated at some length with Stephen Law on the last program, is the scientist, the atheist who comes back to you and simply says, well, look, it sort of makes sense that the beliefs that give us, that help us to survive, are usually correlate with true beliefs, because it's when we find out the truth about reality that we're most likely to survive, and in that sense, if we know that food is in that direction, we're going to go in that direction because that's the truth of the matter, if you like. I'm sure there are other examples you could give. So why for you is it not necessarily the case that the beliefs that aid us in our survival, if you like, are not necessarily going to give us true beliefs generally?
Well, I mean, maybe they are. I can concede that for the moment anyway. What's most important here is that this doesn't hold for beliefs about say metaphysics, what the world is really like, whether there's such a person as God or not. Those are beliefs in that whole area where naturalists, of course, do hold beliefs, are ones where our evolving wouldn't lead to our holding true beliefs. It just wouldn't matter for our survival one way or the other what we thought about those things. So that's really the idea.
And in that sense, for us to have any, I suppose, certainty about those beliefs, it fits better in a theistic framework than a naturalistic framework, where we could assume that if there is a God, then that God would want us to believe things that are true in that sense.
Right. Especially about himself. Right?
Sure.
Right.
Well, let's ask another question here that came in from Paul D. Adams. He says, though not explicitly laid out in your book where the conflict really lies, aren't you proffering three versions of evolution for your argument to succeed? Firstly, unguided evolution, and that's incompatible with theism and with itself, hence the deep conflict. But secondly, guided evolution, and that is compatible with theism and reason. And evolution qua evolution, he says, thirdly, the evolutionary mechanism itself, apart from intentionality, guided or unguided, is compatible with theism and reason. So I guess the question is, are you open to a form of evolution which is compatible with theism and reason and so on?
Certainly, I certainly am. Seems to me there is very good evidence for some evolutionary processes having taken place. I don't know whether the evidence is as powerful as some atheists and the like take it to be, but there is certainly some evidence for that, and there's no reason why God could not have created human beings or the rest of the living world by virtue of such a process. That's one way God could have done it if he saw fit to.
Well, thank you very much. Given us a helpful little taster, at least, of the evolutionary argument against naturalism. And of course, if people want to read further, Where the Conflict Really Lies obviously spells it out in a lot more detail and helpfully engages with a lot of the contemporary voices in that whole discussion as well. Let's go again to one or two other general questions before we move into a final area looking at the ontological argument in the final section of the programme. Here's one that from Jeff, who asks, I'm curious as to whether Alvin feels he is an equal part philosopher as he is a theologian, or if he comes to one from the other. What do you say to that, Alvin?
I would say that these labels are not all that important. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are obviously parts of philosophy that are not theological, and there are maybe parts of theology that aren't philosophical, but they do overlap in certain areas, and in those areas it doesn't really matter whether you say you're doing philosophy or you're doing theology. It's just not, it's not an important question.
Here's a big one, but we don't have much time, I'm afraid, so you'll need to answer it in a minute or two. But Jeff Howells asks, do Christians and Muslims worship the same God? What do you think of that?
Well, it's hard to understand that question. There is only one God in all. So if Christians and Muslims each worship a God, they'd be worshiping that God, that being the only one there are. But I'm not sure exactly how to understand the question beyond that. I mean, God as Muslims think about him is somewhat different from God as Christians think about God. But that's perfectly okay. I mean, it could be that two people thinking about a third person disagree on some of the properties of that person, but they're still talking about that person. So, I mean, I guess my suggestion would be, yes, Christians and Muslims are worshipping the same God, but they don't hold the same beliefs about that God.
Yes, they may have a very different idea of the God that they are worshipping. I suppose that my follow-up question would be, do you believe God accepts worship equally from both sides? or is it not your position to say that kind of a thing?
I don't really know about that. Yeah. I'll have to leave that to God. I don't know.
some questions, yes, you're not qualified to necessarily know.
That's above my pay grade.
Look, we'll go to a break here, Alvin, and we'll come back to pick up some final questions on the ontological argument. So we're covering a lot of bases on the show today. We're having a whistle-stop tour of Alvin Plantinga's philosophical career, really, here, as we ask him lots of questions that you sent in recently. It's on the occasion of him being awarded the Templeton Prize, of course. If you want to find out more about that, there'll be links from today's show as well. And we're looking forward to hearing what he has to say when he receives that prize officially at the end of September. But for the moment, do come back for the third and final part of today's show in just a moment. Moment's time. We're celebrating Wonder Women in the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine as the United Reformed Church marks 100 years of female ordination this month. What can Jeremy Corbyn's youth revolution teach us about engaging young people in the church? 50 years on from 1967's Summer of Love, we'll examine what the Jesus People hippie revolution did for the church. Plus, top US theologian Stanley Hauerwas on war, peace, and Donald Trump. All that plus much more. Ask for a free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample. Welcome back to the final part of Unbelievable this week with me, Justin Brierley, sitting down today with renowned Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga. We'll be having some of your feedback, especially to a show that took place over the summer on whether we can find the Trinity in the Old Testament. That got a lot of responses to it, and I'm still working through the backlog of feedback that came in over the summer break. Thanks to all those who've been in touch as well about Unbelievable, the book, over the summer. It's exciting times. It's actually gone to a third printing here in the UK. And I know that it'll be hitting US bookstores as well by the end of October. Now, I know lots of people in the US have already ordered it via Amazon and received it that way, but I'm looking forward to actually going into US bookstores. Perhaps if you have one nearby, a Christian bookstore that you think should be stocking it, you could tell them about it as well. You can find out more about the book, of course, at unbelievablebook.co.uk. Exclusive signed copies there and links to where you can get the audiobook too. And thanks to those who've been in touch to say they've been enjoying listening to the book. We're heading into a busy old time as well in October, because there's a number of conferences going on, obviously themed around the Reformation. Ken Brownell, who's a former guest on this show and a pastor of a church in London, wanted to get in touch to say on the evening of Friday 6th and all day the 7th of October, we're hosting the London Reformation 500 conference with Christian Heritage London. Gary Williams, Pete Woodcock, Ben Virgo and I will be speaking, with music inspired by the Reformation provided by the Dei Gratia Ensemble. So if you want to find out more about that, londonreformation500.eventbrite.co.uk, or you can email inquiries@christianheritagelondon.org. But lots of other conferences going on, and in fact on the very same dates, the Movement Day conference is happening in Westminster Central Hall in London. That very much a unity movement between Christians who want to transform society. I know that influencers from all over the UK will be descending on London to get together and network and talk about how we can transform the nation. If you want to find out more about that, movementday.uk. Again, the 6th and 7th of October that's happening in Central London. Straight after today's show, if you can stick around here on Premier Christian Radio, as part of Faith Explored, the profiles here, Sam Hales, between 4 and 5, will be chatting with Alistair Begg, a British preacher who leads a large church out in the USA, talking about his radio ministry and why he left the shores of Scotland for the US, and of course the profile available as a podcast too, if you want to search that up on iTunes or whatever software you use to download podcasts, and of course Unbelievable available that way as well, and lots of our back catalogue available to search through as well online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there, of course, to this year's Unbelievable conference on DVD, MP3 CD and digital download. Brilliant speakers there were: John Lennox, Andy Bannister, Beth Grove, Jeremiah J. Johnston and many more besides, and what was a wonderful day here in Central London. So don't miss getting that as well. So much to offer now through the Unbelievable stable. I wouldn't want you to miss any of it. And just before we go into the final segment of our conversation, I just wanted to as well, for those who aren't aware, remind us that of our dear friend Nabil Qureshi, who has been on the show several times in previous years. And if anyone has been following his video updates on YouTube or Facebook, and I've been posting them as well on the Unbelievable Facebook page, you'll know that he got diagnosed with cancer over a year ago, advanced stomach cancer, and the prognosis is not good for his future. He's currently gone into palliative care. The medical advice is that they're not going to be attempting to treat the cancer any longer. So barring a miracle, it is a terminal diagnosis for Nabeel. I know that thousands of people have been praying for him and that he has appreciated that, but he's facing it with remarkable fortitude and faith as well in the face of that. But could I encourage you, if you are the praying sort, to perhaps send a prayer up for Nabeel as well.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, we're concluding my conversation with Alvin Plantinga, and what a delight it's been to be joined by Alvin Plantinga on the show today. Emeritus Professor of Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame and this year's Templeton Prize winner, an award given to a living individual who's made an exceptional contribution to affirming life's spiritual dimension. I've been able to interview the last two winners of the prize, so it's turning into a bit of a tradition to interview the prize winner here on Unbelievable. Again, if you want to get in touch with the show and share your thoughts, you can do that by email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I'll give out the other ways to get in touch as well a little bit later on the show. Of course, Alvin has been awarded this prize for his long career bringing arguments for God back into the mainstream of academic philosophy. We've had a whistle-stop tour of a number of the areas that he's worked on and that people have been asking questions about. I asked you to send in your question by email, Twitter and Facebook. And we've arrived at probably one of the most difficult, sort of conceptually difficult philosophical arguments for the existence of God, but one which you've had a hand in reviving and putting your own modal spin on, Alvin, and you'll have to define some of these things for us. It's the ontological argument. And before we get into a few of the questions that came in on this, perhaps you'd help us out by just describing quickly what the ontological argument is and a brief summary of how you've developed it as an argument for the existence of God.
Well, the ontological argument was put forward by Saint Anselm many, many centuries ago. And his basic idea was that God is a being than which none greater can be conceived. God is the greatest conceivable being. God is a being than which none greater can be conceived. But a being that doesn't even exist could hardly be thought of as to be one than which none greater can be conceived. Being doesn't even exist wouldn't amount to much. Therefore, God must exist. Mm. This argument seems to me, as it stands, is not a good argument. When the premise is God is a being in which none greater can be conceived, what that really means is if God exists, then he's a being in which none greater can be conceived. The idea of God is an idea of a being in which none greater can be conceived. And so if there is such a person as God, then God is a being in which none greater can be conceived. But of course, that premise won't give us the conclusion that God actually does exist.
Mm.
So my way of thinking about a sort of ontological argument, or one somewhat similar to that, is like this. God is, if there is such a person as God, God is a necessary being, one who exists necessarily, one who can't fail to exist, one who exists, you might say, in all possible worlds.
Mm.
But if that's so, then if it's even possible that there is such a person as God, there is such a person as God. And it certainly seems plausible to think that it's possible that there is such a person. So that's a sort of revised ontological argument.
And it's called, it's modal. What does that mean? You help us, give us a little bit of a philosophy tutorial here and what it means to describe this as the modal version of the ontological argument.
Well, modality has to do with different forms something can take. So here we're thinking about truth. There is necessary truth, truths that couldn't possibly not have been true, that couldn't possibly have been false, like 2 plus 1 equals 3, for example. And then there are other truths that are contingent. They are, in fact, true, but they could have been false. For example, the United States has, I don't know, more than 300 million inhabitants. I think that's true. If it is, though, it certainly could have been false, and when at times in the past was false.
It's not necessarily true, yes. And in a sense, when we put God in this category of being a necessary being, it means that if that means his existence is possible, then his existence is by definition necessary, and therefore he must exist in all possible worlds. That's the thought.
The premise is that it is possible that there be such a person.
Therefore, God exists in all possible worlds, including this one. It's such an interesting argument, but I know that people when we've debated it on this program before, I've had atheist philosopher Peter Millikan debating it before, and I think he's described it as a sort of an interesting argument, but one which essentially sort of defines God into existence by some clever wordplay, as though Christians are kind of just inventing God by defining God in a certain way. Suddenly you've got a God. I mean, is that a fair criticism of the ontological argument, Alvin?
I don't think it is. Well, first of all, not nearly all Christians embrace the ontological argument. Most Christians never even heard of it, let alone believe on the basis of it. So I don't think that'd be the right way to put it. Also, it doesn't define God into existence. It's not possible to define really anything into existence. You can't get it to exist by producing a definition. I guess what these objectors really mean, or what they should mean, is that there's something fishy about this argument. But I don't think there's anything fishy about it. What the opponent of the argument should do is simply deny that premise according to which it's possible that there be such a person as God. And that seems to me to be the right way to oppose the argument, not to claim that it's fishy or...
Yeah. And
they do it in various other ways.
And they do that presumably by showing some kind of logical inconsistency in the concept or something, I suppose, is the route you'd have to go to do that.
Well, they'd have to do that, or they'd have to say it's not possible that there be a being such that being couldn't possibly fail to exist.
Right. Let's go to some of the questions that came in then on the ontological argument. I've got one here from Phil Kalberg. He says, like many others, I want to express my appreciation for the work you've done. God, Freedom and Evil was one of the first philosophical works I read, and it challenged my thinking and is part of what inspired me to get into philosophy. And Phil says, I want to ask you about your version of the ontological argument. I know you've written that you don't think the ontological argument proves the existence of God, rather that it simply demonstrates that it's rational to believe in God. In my thesis, I came to a similar conclusion, that the ontological argument demonstrates that either God exists necessarily or that God is impossible and cannot exist. Since the ontological argument demonstrates that the possibility of a necessary being is equivalent to the actual existence of that same being, then it follows that God must exist, or that God must not exist, and hence agnosticism is untenable. So do you think that this take on the ontological argument still falls into something like the idea that belief in God is rational, or do you think there's something wrong with that take on it? And additionally, if time permits, could you speak to how it's the case that the ontological argument does or does not beg the question? It seems to me that the ontological argument does beg the question if you attempt to prove God's existence with it, but not if you argue for a lesser conclusion such that it's rational to believe in God or that God's possibility entails his existence. Thank you again for your work, example, and any time you spend responding to my question. So this is quite an involved question here from Phil Kalberg is asking this question out in the USA. Let's begin with that whole question of are you simply saying that this demonstrates that it's rational to believe in God rather than proving the existence of God? Which is it that you're saying?
Well, I don't think it proves the existence of God. I think it's sort of hard to know exactly what a proof is anyway, but in this particular case, I think the premise and the conclusion are too close together for it to be a really powerful argument. I mean, the premise, if God is thought of as a necessary being, then that he exists and that he's possible are just too close together. They're too close together to make it much of an argumentative advance.
Okay.
Anybody who understood the premise would automatically think of the conclusion as following. So I don't propose it as a really strong argument. It's more like part of the logical geography of God and of divinity.
So what do you say to his idea that, do you think that this take on the ontological argument falls into something like the idea that belief in God is rational, or do you think there's something wrong with that? I mean, is it essentially the milder claim that belief in God is rational rather than a sort of claim that God exists because of this argument?
That's a claim that I did make, but I'm not so sure that it shows even that.
Okay.
Not, of course, that I don't think belief in God is rational. I certainly do. Not only do I think it's rational, I think it's true.
Yes.
But I don't know that this argument even shows that it's rational. And again, for the same reason that these two things would be too close together, the premise and conclusion would be too close together. It doesn't seem to me... It really doesn't seem to me the argument shows much at all.
Okay.
It's not one of the more powerful arguments, I would say, for the existence of God.
And in that sense, you may have already answered Mason Kelso's question, which came in by Facebook, who asked, after all these years, how confident are you still that your modal ontological argument is successful? I mean, it sounds like you're saying, let's not put too much weight on this particular argument, Alvin.
Yes, that's what I would say now, and I guess that's substantially what I thought when I wrote about it. The only difference is now I guess now I don't think it shows even that it's rational to believe in God. Again, not that I don't think it is,
sure.
I certainly do think it is,
yeah.
But I don't really think this argument shows that.
It wouldn't be this argument you would turn to in order to show that belief is rational. That's interesting, and obviously, you know, evidence that you're obviously open to changing and revising your views on what the strengths and weaknesses are of particular philosophical arguments as you've gone through that. Obviously, the ontological argument has not been a major focus for you in quite a long time, and these other elements of the evolutionary argument against naturalism and others that have obviously occupied much of your recent work. But just continuing, just to one more question on this. Do you consider God to be a necessary being, ask blue-collar apologist, or only consider his non-existence to be necessarily true or false if he does or doesn't exist? Do you? I guess that's an interesting question there. Do you think God is a necessary being, or is that sort of open for debate as far as you're concerned?
I think God is a necessary being. I don't think it's possible that there should be no such person as God. So I do think that God is a necessary being. It's just that I don't think so on the basis of the ontological argument.
I see. Thank you. Let's finish up with a more general question here. A couple of them, in fact. Joachim wanted to ask, what advice would you give to Christians planning to study philosophy? What advice would you give, Alvin?
Well, I guess I don't have any particularly interesting or insightful advice there. I would just say, have at it, get at it, and don't confine yourself to just one area in philosophy, but try to study the whole gamut of philosophy. There's lots of different sides to it, lots of different areas to think about in it. And a proper philosopher, it seems to me, ought to be acquainted with all of it.
And Randall asks, who is the most influential Christian philosopher to you?
I wonder what exactly, any of, say, philosophers from the past, then I would say Augustine and Aquinas.
Okay.
Contemporary Christian philosophers, I would suggest Peter van Inwagen or Robert and Marilyn Adams, maybe, or others. I mean, there's just there are lots of interesting and worthwhile contemporary Christian philosophers.
Well, thank you so much for the time you've given today. I know that many people answering that question themselves would put your name on the list, Alvin, and I want to give my personal thanks for, the decades of work that you've poured into your life in academic circles and, of course, the works and talks and much else that people have benefited from. And again, congratulations on receiving this year's Templeton Prize, and thank you for being with me on the programme today.
Thanks very much, Justin.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Email us, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, if you'd like to get in touch that way. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/unbelievablejb. Twitter is @unbelievablejb to follow the show that way. And as I mentioned, I always post regular updates about the show and other items of interest on the show Facebook and Twitter page week by week. Thanks to all those who've been in touch about that episode where we debated the Trinity and whether we can find it in the Old Testament. Imam Musharraf Hussain was our Muslim guest and Glenn Scrivener was our Christian thinker on that one. Lots of varied responses to this. Michael Brady says, how on earth can one hope to have a balanced discussion of the Hebrew Scriptures without involving at least one scholar of the Jewish faith, which wrote it? It's a Jewish book, adopted and adapted to Christian and Muslim purposes, as both guests engaged in the thrust and parry of what sounds like their usual anti-Islamic and anti-Christian apologetic. Find myself asking again and again, why not ask a Hebrew scholar if they find a Trinitarian Christian God in their book? Well, that could easily have been the focus as well, Michael, though obviously both Muslims and Christians sort of see the Old Testament as their scriptures as well as Jewish people. So in a sense, I think it makes sense to have those types of perspectives in the studio. I'm sure we will and have done that, the Jewish perspective as well on that. Ben in Rochester, Michigan says, I understand the desire to respect the Islamic faith, but the specific topic for this episode was to revolve around the Old Testament, an authoritative document for both Islam and Christianity. I don't believe the Imam made a single reference to the Old Testament during the entire discussion, but returned over and again to the Quran and general Islamic doctrine. I've noticed it's difficult sometimes to keep Muslims on topic in these, but sorry to say this, that's something you need to work harder to achieve, as it changed what could have been an informative program into virtually a waste of time, with the two going down entirely different program. It was a great program concept, but the execution was lacking. Thank you, Ben. I take that constructive criticism on the chin. This one from Jim Carpinelli. This was on Facebook. He left a message. Truly enjoy listening to Unbelievable. The discussions are predominantly congenial, but this discussion was frustrating on two key points. Firstly, Musharraf repeated the deceptive point that the Trinity is a 4th century invention, which went uncorrected every time. Questioning the deity of Christ is the earliest and most frequent heresy corrected throughout the New Testament, thus prior to 325 AD. Secondly, once the incorrect position held by Musharraf regarding physical begetting of the Son was established, there was no time left for correction. It's the nature, I'm afraid, of these debates that you don't always get the chance to answer every single thing that comes up, but appreciate you making an attempt to do that yourself, Jim. This from Sam Carlton says, long-time faithful listener, Trinity in the Old Testament was a wonderful show. It's not often these days I get to hear the truth that Musharraf stated about the fact Islam does see Jesus as a great prophet. In my opinion, anytime anyone embraces Jesus in any love-centric way is moving in the right direction. At the very end of the programme, Musharraf sincerely asked the question, why would God want to become weak? And to that I say, amen and amen. Why would God want to become weak? It is indeed scandalous that the Almighty God would become weak. But there is a ton of scripture that clearly states that is exactly what happens. 2 Corinthians 12:9, Paul writes that the Lord said, my grace is sufficient for you, my power made perfect in weakness. The true beauty and power of the gospel is that it is scandalous. Take the parable of the prodigal son. Scandalous for a father who represents God to run to his wayward son. Men didn't run in that culture. Then to throw a party for that son rather than stone him. Complete and total scandal. Keep up the good work. Bruxy said he was going to be on the show. What's the topic? When does it air? That's Bruxy Cavey. Yes, I've recorded a not a full edition of the show, just an interview really about his latest book, Reunion, and hoping to play that out probably next week, at the end of next week's show, in fact. So look out for that, Sam, then. Here's Tim in, I can never pronounce this, Saskatchewan, Canada, I think. Just finished the podcast between Glenn and Musharraf. I was pleasantly surprised by both parties. They both represented rejected the orthodox view of their position. Often I find when arguing orthodox Christianity from the Old Testament, many scholars tend to take a rather liberal view and treat the Old Testament like Play-Doh rather than inspired text. I found it interesting how, even though Glenn made the point you can't just assume Unitarianism, that frequently Musharraf based his argument on assuming Unitarianism. He consistently misrepresented the Trinity by calling it three gods, or that the Father was part God, which largely went uncontested by Glenn. On the other side, I found it disappointing that Glenn missed a number of gospel softballs, such as when Musharraf asked, why would God want to become a man? To which the answer is a resounding, so that God could justly condemn sin, a concept that sadly was missing in the discussion. As Glenn pointed out, the Trinity is the only concept that enables a holy and separate God to condescend and take away human sin without violating his justice or holiness. As Romans says, God is the just and the justifier. God, through the Trinity, can be just and forgiving, as opposed to Allah, who is forgiving but unjust. A cursory read of the Hadith, in which the man who killed 99 people, illustrates this point. In this story, the man was forgiven, not based on repentance, but rather Allah's violation of justice, in that Allah forgives without payment, repentance or contrition on the man's part. Another thing I wish could have been fleshed out a little more, the Quran explicitly denies the Trinity in Surah An-Nisa, the famous Do Not Say Three passage. However, if one were to look at the three that the Quran puts forth, you will not find Father, Son and Holy Spirit, rather you'll find the Father, Son and Mary. The Quran misrepresents the Orthodox Trinity, and most Muslims understand more of the Orthodox teachings of God than the writer of the Quran did. Thank you very much. Love the show. Keeps me thinking, which I believe is the point. Appreciate that sign off, Tim. And here's one quickly from Kyle. Says, really enjoyed this show. Christians need to understand Muslim theology if we're going to defend against it. And I think we have a very poor understanding of it at present. Listening to Glenn give scriptural examples of how God came into our existence in the Old Testament, there was one example he didn't give that I'd be curious to know how Imam Musharraf would respond. In Daniel 3, in the story of the fiery furnace, it states, then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the fire? They answered and said to the king, true, O king. He answered and said, but I see four men, unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. I've always been told that this fourth person was likely Jesus. Therefore, that would further prove exclusive of the New Testament that Jesus existed prior to his human birth. Okay, that's all we've time for. With your responses to the Old Testament and Trinity debate of a few weeks ago. If you've got further thoughts, feel free to send them in. And of course, on today's show as well, look forward to hearing what you had to say about that. But for the moment, it's great to have had you on the programme today. Let me tell you what's coming up next week. You're unbelievable. Well, we're developing a little bit of a mini-series here, in as much as I'm going to be doing another one-to-one conversation. For those who love just hearing the debates, don't worry, those will be back on the menu from the following week. But another great opportunity came up recently. Another very influential thinker, Rodney Stark, who's well known as a sociologist of religion and for books like The Rise of Christianity. He's going to be in conversation with me, answering a number of questions that you, the unbelievable listeners, sent in to him. His latest book is called Reformation Myths. As we mark globally 500 years of the Reformation this year and into October. So I hope you can come back for that. Rodney Stark on the show next week. Until then, have a good week. And I'm handing you over now to Sam Hales on The Profile.